Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Nicholas Kristof is a New York Times columnist, a 2-time Pulitzer recipient, and a strong advocate for human rights. His latest book is a memoir called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Kristof will be speaking at Trinity University's Maverick Lecture Thursday, September 19th, a free lecture. There's more information on our website at tpr.org. And Nick, welcome to The Source.
Great to be with you.
So you had described yourself as a West Coast liberal. But now you've come out recently critical of West Coast liberalism as not working, not practical, and needs to be reimagined. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, you simply can't walk through downtown San Francisco or downtown Portland and feel this is a triumph of good government. And you know, we fundamentally do have real problems with homelessness, with law and order, and with outcomes. There's this gulf between our values and our outcomes in the West Coast blue spaces. And look, I'm a very much a committed liberal. I look around the country and I see blue states that have, you know, I think it's 3 years longer life expectancy than red states, that have higher high school graduation rates, that have economies that are doing better, and indeed the gap is growing. But I think we also have to look deeply at the places where we are in charge and acknowledge that we have screwed up. And, you know, I think part of the problem, frankly, is a sort of a lack of accountability that, I mean, and it runs all around the country, that in a lot of blue parts of the country, like the cities on the West Coast, Republicans don't matter, and so Democrats don't have to deliver. And likewise, I think in a lot of red parts of the country, you know, Democrats don't matter, and so Republicans haven't had to deliver, and that isn't good. That isn't good for either space. I think, you know, we can all do better.
Yeah, so I've heard you talking about this, and of course I read your column about it, and I flipped it on its head in my mind thinking about Texas. And, you know, as you say, you know, California, yeah, the Republicans don't matter. Here in Texas, as of now, there hasn't been a Democrat who's won a statewide election in 30 years. And so, yep, you know, the contrast between the two, but we have the same problems here. I mean, they're not, you know, there is no homelessness. There is no of these types of problems here.
Yeah. And so I think in, you know, red parts of the country, the problems are often more to do with child poverty, with medical care. You know, I mean, the fact that 10 states still haven't still haven't expanded Medicaid, when, you know, this would actually save money, when health outcomes would increase. There are a dozen counties around the U.S., probably all in red states, that have a shorter life expectancy than Bangladesh. You know, there are real fail, and I frankly, I'd put abortion politics in that the leadership in red states have often been much more conservative than voters have been. But because Democrats don't matter in those places, so it's become possible for leaders in red states to have a more right-wing position that caters to Republican voters in primaries, who obviously are further to the right. And in the same way that, you know, that on the West Coast, that Democratic politicians cater to Democratic primary voters. And so, you know, each side is being tugged further afield. And I think, you know, ordinary citizens sometimes get hurt at both ends.
So our phone lines are open. If you got a question or comment for New York Times columnist, Pulitzer Prize winner, human rights advocate Nicholas Kristof, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. I did get an email question for you, Nick. It's from Melissa May. How do you balance journalism ethical standards, without advocating for, let me say this again. How do you balance journalistic ethical standards with advocating for people and policies to do the right thing?
So I'm a columnist, so I am paid to inflict my views on other people. So I'm not a reporter in the sense of being neutral. I am an opinion journalist. I did spend most of my career as a reporter and a foreign correspondent. And you know, there one thing I talk about in my new book is just the ethical conflicts that arise. And the most difficult decision I've ever had to make was when I was a foreign correspondent in China covering in the aftermath of the Tiananmen massacre in 1989. There was a young man who had helped us cover the protests. He was imprisoned. He escaped from prison, and he asked for my help fleeing the country. And you know, the one pretty basic rule of being a foreign correspondent is you don't help an escaped felon flee the country. On the other hand, you know, here's this 19-year-old guy who was already in prison because he'd helped New York Times readers. If I didn't help him, at some point he was going to be caught. And I just agonized over my responsibilities. And I, in the end, I did help him, and he was able to get out to Hong Kong, and then I helped him get to the U.S., so he's now an American. But it was maybe the most unprofessional thing I've ever done, but also one that I'm proudest of. And at the end of the day, we are journalists, but we are also humans. We have human responsibilities to each other. And I think, there have been these really tough issues close to the line, just I try to disclose to readers things like that and do things that I hope, 10 years later, I'll be proud of.
So we have the standards, straight reporting, and the idea of balancing your coverage. And that's as if all parties are normal and are acting in good faith. There are still lots of reporting that goes on, giving the benefit of the doubt to everyone involved as if they are acting in good faith and they are normal. And so... And here in journalism, we say, okay, we have to stay on this side of the line to not stray into opinion. But, how close to the line can we get? I think we should be our toes should be on that line.
So, particularly with the Donald Trump issue came up, how do we...
You know what? I'm going to have to. We're going to hit this break. We're going to come back to that, and we'll get right back to picking up where we left off. And we're going to call you back because our phone line got a little garbled. And hopefully, we can call you back and fix all that. But Nicholas Kristof, more from him when we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with Nicholas Kristof, New York Times columnist, 2 times Pulitzer recipient, and advocate for human rights. He will be speaking at Trinity University's Maverick Lecture Thursday, September 19th. It is free. There's more information on our website at tpr.org. So Nick, I think we got you back and the line is clear. So what's your reaction to the question? How do we play this now?
So there's a tension between what we do in journalism in terms of where we should be fair, and we should also tell our audiences what we know, tell them the truth. And most of the time, those go together. And we can convey the truth by providing balance and quoting people on all sides. But that doesn't always work. And so, like in the 1950s, during the Joe McCarthy period, it didn't work to quote Joe McCarthy and then to the people he and then quote the people he accused of being communists, because people thought, well, maybe they are communists, and you know, journalists knew they weren't. It didn't work in the civil rights period to quote George Wallace on one hand and Martin Luther King on the other, as if they were equally reliable as sources. And it seems to me the same issue has come up with Donald Trump. And I was struck in the 2016 election that in polls, the public said that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were about equally reliable, about equally close to the truth. And in fact, I think every reporter who covered the election knew that Hillary Clinton was sort of fairly typical in her, you know, her tendency periodically to stretch things, to spin, and Donald Trump was just off the charts. And I don't think we conveyed that truth to our audiences. And I think that when there is that tension between our responsibility to be fair and balanced on the one hand, and our responsibility to tell the truth on the other, the paramount obligation is truth, is to tell readers what we know. And, you know, and that's what we do when we cover the world, when I'm covering China or when I'm covering Vladimir Putin, that I'm respectful to Putin. I say that he calls it a special military operation in Ukraine rather than an invasion. But I also make very clear to people that, yes, it is an invasion. You know, I do try to let people know the truth as I understand it. And, you know, that's hard to get right. We don't always, we periodically screw up, but I think that should be our aspiration.
Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255. And Carol, you're on the air with Nicholas Kristof.
Okay. First of all, I've heard you interviewed other times about your, and covering some of what you've already said, including your experience with the person in Tiananmen Square and so forth. And I highly respect your long standing worldview in journalism and humanitarian reporting and journalism that you've done. I also heard in those interviews the background you had raised by the parents that you had, but also with the perspective you had in small town Oregon, right? And
that's right.
But also rose to prominence pretty quickly in recognition, even in high school, for the talent that you had and the support that you had. So a lot of privilege along the way, including now. So that
yep.
being said, I want to pick up on a particular theme that you started with, the red and the blue and accountability, for just a moment, please. I agree that it is not a red or blue being preferable. That, for instance, here in which I most am acquainted with long on several aspects and life and experiences over 50 years, that the dominantly red state with what is often perceived as and bandied and sometimes derided as blue city.
Right.
Accountability is greatly lacking in the, I'm going to raise two areas. Well, in
Carol, can you kind of wrap it up?
We got sure. Housing is in extreme crisis, and and the priority in terms of where monies are spent, huge amounts as well as tax money.
Carol, we got to let you go. Thank you so much. So, Nicholas.
I think housing is, frankly, you know, one of the biggest challenges in blue cities around the country, but it's much more evident in the West Coast, and that's partly because they are home to a great deal of wealth, and they've done very well economically, so people bid up the prices. But I think fundamentally it's about policy, and that that there are evidence-based policies that really can improve things. I spent time in Houston and Dallas looking at housing policies in each city. You know, both are blue cities, both have had problems with homelessness, both tried seriously to address them. And in Dallas, the problem got worse. And in Houston, they reduced homelessness by 60%. That's not enough. There are still problems in both places. But it's not just good intentions. Good intentions are not enough. It's about metrics. It's about using the best, most cost-effective approaches, tracking homeless folks. It's not about slogans about saying housing is a human right. It's about actually delivering housing at prices people can afford. And so I think that Houston-Dallas divide sort of and actually, to Dallas's credit, in the last couple of years, it has learned from Houston's success and is now emulating it and is now doing a little better. So, I think, we got to focus on evidence and what works and less about ideology and slogans.
So, Nick Kristof, you're known for doing investigative journalism in far-off places on the planet where horrible things are happening, human atrocities are. And writing about that, but how do you get the editors to buy in on before you became the big Nicholas Kristof, where you can write whatever about whatever you want now? But it couldn't have always been easy to get the editors to say, "Oh yeah, Darfur, let's do something on that," or they didn't push you back and say most people don't even know where that is.
You know, it's hard. And I've been very lucky that, I was at the New York Times and the New York Times is willing to lose money on my reporting. There was one time when I made what I did back-to-back columns about Brett Kavanaugh when he was up for the Supreme Court and about Yemen, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And, the Brett Kavanaugh piece I did in a few hours. It was very easy to do. And the Yemen piece, I traveled to Yemen. It was dangerous. It was expensive. And it wasn't just that the Brett Kavanaugh piece got, 20% more page views or doubled the number of page views. It had seven times as many page views. And so, it's kind of true that no executive producer or no editor in their right mind, if they're a care about audience, is going to send reporters off to cover Yemen or Darfur or whatever it may be. And I do think that reporters have to push to cover these things. I think that audiences have to push and that we in journalism have to acknowledge that we see our profession. I think most of us went into this profession because we believed it can do some good and that carries with it some obligation, not just to cover celebrity and things that are already on the agenda, but to try to cover things that are off the agenda and thereby propel them onto the agenda.
So in your memoir, your latest book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, it's been described as how you're dealing with the PTSD of all the horrible things that you've had to witness and write about.
Yeah, I kind of self-diagnosed myself earlier when I was writing the book with a mild case of PTSD. And it's from, being held at gunpoint in more places than I can count and seeing a lot of massacres in a lot of places. I think that it helped, and I found a certain amount of healing in finding purpose in my journalism and thinking that here and there, it is possible to make a difference and reduce the scale of those challenges. And I also incredibly lucky to have a, you know, a family that is wonderfully supportive. And I, you know, I just deeply believe in what I'm doing. And I think that is in part healing.
And now you're turning your eye closer to the Middle East, looking at what's happening with Gaza. You've been critical of how Joe Biden has dealt with Biden. He said he's been slow to act, basically giving Israel permission to launch their attacks. So what's next?
Well, I mean, I will, you know, I will continue to report on Gaza and the Middle East. I just think it's a immense tragedy, and that the U.S. Should not allow its weapons to be used indefinitely to, you know, to continue this scale of killing in Gaza.
I mean, people are calling for an arms embargo, a U.S. arms embargo against with Israel. Is that practical?
I don't know that. I mean, I wouldn't quite say that all arms shipments should be stopped, but I think that one could pause on shipments of offensive weapons that are, you know, not used for defense, but for offense until a ceasefire is reached, and that we have leverage. That is how we get countries to do things. And I think the Biden administration has not used that leverage. I think he's allowed Netanyahu to kind of walk all over him in ways that have been bad for the U.S. and certainly bad for Gaza. And so, yeah, in that more limited area, I'd favor limits on transfers of offensive weapons. I'll be covering. There's a humanitarian crisis in Sudan. I'm going to the region soon to cover that. And also, I mean, the other topic that has really grabbed me has been kind of the struggles in working class America. I'm from a community that has been really badly hit by meth in particular, and more recently by, you know, by opioids and fentanyl. And a third of the kids on my old school bus at this point are dead from drugs, alcohol, and suicide. And that has really torn me up. And I don't think that we in the country, in this country, have adequately faced the tragedy that is unfolding in a lot of rural and small town America. I mean, and cities too, from people who've been left behind economically and are now wrestling with addiction problems that are just mind-boggling.
Yeah, the diseases of despair and loneliness, you know, what tools can we just deploy to help people in these areas? Is it just a job, you think?
I think that jobs matter an awful lot. And, you know, in my area, it was loss of sawmills, it was loss of small factories, and then men self-medicated. This was a low education area, so people weren't equipped for 21st century jobs. I think we've got to do a much better job with addiction treatment. Only 10 to 20% of people with addictions have access to that. But maybe most important, we've got to do a better job with young people and get them educated in a way that they can compete for jobs in the future.
You sound like a West Coast liberal.
You know, I'm a West Coast liberal who believes in outcomes, not just in our slogans.
American pragmatism to the rescue. Nicholas,
that's right.
Christoph, thank you so much for talking to us today. He will be lecturing, a free lecture to the public, Thursday, September 19th at Trinity University's Maverick Lecture. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Dave. See ya.
That's The Source. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us.